Well, it is that time of the morning and that time of the week for our Friday political panel. Joining me this week is Mark Kenny. Mark is a professor at ANU's Australian Studies Institute and host of the sizzling podcast called The Democracy Sausage. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Sally.
And Karen Middleton is here as well. Karen, political journalist, author and columnist with The Monthly. Karen, happy Friday to you.
And to you, Sally.
And Mel Clark. Happy Friday to you, Mel
Very
Clark.
Happy Friday for me and many, I'm sure.
Now, Mark, I'll begin with you. What do you make of the federal government's strategy of playing whack-a-mole with social media platforms? We're just hearing from young Riley on Eyre Peninsula in South Australia. Like with anything, the kids are looking for the loopholes and other ways around. Is it a sustainable policy, or with high-moving tech, is that all you can do?
I think the answer there is what you said at the end. It is, if this is the policy, if that is the plan to restrict or stop kids under 16 from having access to social media, then how you go about it, that turns out to be critical. But this is new stuff. This is pioneering law. This is new law. It's an important thing to remember, I think, about this. And as you say, kids are very tech savvy. They're digital natives. They've grown up with this stuff, and they understand it in ways that most of the rest of us don't and probably never will. So I think it's going to be a work in progress, and there will be loopholes in it, and we know this in terms of social media platforms as well. They grow like Topsy. They come out of nowhere, and we hear names mentioned in this discussion that most of us go, I haven't even heard of that platform yet. Even some people in the industry admit they haven't heard of that platform. That is going to be the case going forward. So I think it's probably whack-a-mole's essentially the strategy, and we'll just see whether it actually works well enough to even be worth doing.
The way that these laws are structured, rather than having some blanket ban, it is naming platforms. Is that specificity, is it a point of strength in these laws, or is it the key vulnerability, Karen?
Well, it's probably both. I mean, the problem that government's got is in the definition of social media, and because technology's changing all the time and platforms are developing new capabilities, they have to keep going back to that definition and checking whether new platforms meet it or not. And we saw a lot of kids migrating to platforms like Lemonade and Yolp, and so now they've added those two
platforms. Which I knew about, obviously, before.
Of course.
We were all
on them. Well before that, ahead of the curve, yeah, but just the right generation. But so the technology is developing, and the definition may need to develop as well. I think the other point that's interesting here to the difficulty of implementing this is the government is leaning into encouraging other countries to follow suit. So the international advocacy has been very important, because the more international pressure, the more support there is internationally, the greater the pressure on the tech companies to make sure they do, you know, develop a way to police this properly. So it's a kind of careful pyramid, if you like, and making sure that all these parts fit together, and the international support for this ban is really important.
I found it really interesting that the eSafety Commissioner, right from the beginning of this process, talked about wanting to have a priority approach. She made it very clear that when it came to trying to figure out, you know, which platforms fit in the definition and which don't, and the self-assessment process, she made it very clear that most young people are using a small number of very popular platforms. Talking about Snapchat, TikTok.
They worked because of critical mass.
Correct. They want to be where everyone else is. So she was very clear that all of their attention, or the majority of their attention at the beginning, was on the bigger mainstream platforms where young people are. And that's why they've focused on those ones, rather than, you know, there's been some commentary this week, well, why isn't Blue Sky on there? But the answer is because just not that many 14-year-olds are on Blue Sky. Yo, maybe it's, you know, hitting up the App Store charts because people are looking for alternatives. But of course, that's going to happen through the course of the process. I've heard of some school kids setting up like joint Google documents to type chats on as a way to not use social media, but it's just a Google Doc, but we're still all talking to each other as a communication method, and you can cut and paste a picture into there. Like, they're going to find ways. There are going to be smaller platforms that have niche use. I think the government is very much relying on really strong public sentiment for this to work. There's really goodwill towards the government amongst a huge cohort of parents that want this to work, and I think will be quite forgiving if it doesn't work perfectly from the beginning. And so in a political sense, the government has that as a very big asset of goodwill to work with.
And there's that thing that parents have talked about for a while of actually having a bit of leverage in putting the pressure on their kids to get off their
parents.
Yeah, the minister said, you know, you can make me the bad guy, I'm the bad guy, that's right.
Is it about, Mark, in a way, you're not going to get everywhere, but is it about reflecting and or setting community expectations? Like we're talking with Riley, the age for alcohol is 18. Kids are going to experiment earlier than that, some, but it's saying to the community, this is where it should roughly be. You as a parent, figure out where you sit with that line. There are consequences if you're under it. Is it some of that?
Yeah, I think it's a really important aspect of it. I mean, that is pretty much all you can do. You think about the driving age, the voting age, smoking, drinking, these sorts of things. They're arbitrary. There's an arbitrary sort of cutoff when you're below which you don't have access to these things. And there are some kids, in the case of voting or driving, who would be perfectly safe on the road at 14. But you have to make a decision about it. And the decision about this has been made that there is widespread social harm. What we're talking about here in some ways is protecting kids from adult discourse that is basically appalling. I mean, some of it is discourse amongst themselves, you know, bullying and these kinds of things. But the internet is basically a sewer. Morally, it's a sewer. And the fact that it's not a safe place for kids, I think, says something pretty bad about society more broadly.
And it is a health and safety measure in the end. That's what it is. It's not a rule with no reason. It's there for a reason, safety. And health and safety is the issue.
You're listening to Radio National Breakfast. We're talking about the week in politics with Mark Kenny from the ANU, political columnist and author Karen Middleton, and our own Mel Clark. Karen, let's talk about government transparency. How would you assess the government's response to the Briggs Review, which is a review into, in straight up terms, jobs for mates and the framework that's been put around it? Because there's been quite a wait to get transparency about this report about transparency.
2 years and 4 months is in my count. Yeah, reluctant, I think is the word. Look, this has got a fascinating history, this review. The Finance Minister, Katie Gallagher, announced it in February of 2023, just before Independent MP Sophie Scomps was putting in a private members bill into the House of Representatives to try and overhaul the system of ministers appointing people directly, because there was a sense of kind of cronyism involved in that through successive governments. What has now emerged is that she had a meeting with a government minister a few days before that to alert them that she was going to put this bill through, and before the bill had been drafted, the government came out with its review announcement. So it's an interesting proximity to that the review was announced in the first place, and makes you wonder how high a priority that review was. Lynell Briggs, I'm not sure if she's going to get another government gig, because she's really done a very good job on this one and made them extremely uncomfortable. And when you read this report, you can see why they didn't really want to bring it out. It's highly, highly critical. It says Australia's worse than any other country for this, and that it's the appearance of nepotism and cronyism, and the system doesn't have enough checks and balances in it. And so the government has responded, and I think what they've proposed in the framework is better than what there is now, but it has rejected a lot of the key recommendations that she said were essential, and you just get the feeling that it was inconvenient and they didn't really want to do it.
When we're seeing what's happening from many sides, but particularly from the crossbench, the word transparency has been a significant one already in this term for Anthony Albanese.
It has, and it remains a point of vulnerability for the Labor Party. We know that there is electoral appetite for better transparency, and I think you can see the success of independent candidates that run on transparency platforms as good evidence of that. And when there are a succession of issues, this being one of them, efforts to reform freedom of information laws in the way that it's been done, slow responses to formal processes in the Senate that are designed to extract answers from the government, these things do add up. And it risks creating for Labor the perception that they are no better than the previous coalition government that was in power, or at least not living up to the standards that they had indicated they would bring to the role when they were in opposition. So I think this is, there's a reason that we have many of the independents continuing to push on this, is because there's still a hell of a long way to go to try and get to a better level of transparency from the parties of government.
Karen, we're running out of political days for the year, but we're still expecting...
What a shame.
Crestfallen.
Crestfallen. The Liberals are coming up with their immigration policy. What's the timeline there?
Well, interesting question. I mean, there's a lot of pressure internally to come out quickly with a statement. You know, it's a microcosm of what we saw with the climate issue. But I think they've fixed on this issue as an issue of great excitement and input in the wider community. So they have an incentive, a political incentive to get this done quickly. There is tension within the party as to which direction they should go in, but generally speaking, I think we're going to see them make a statement on numbers and not make the mistake that Peter Dutton made, getting his different kinds of migration confused. They need to make a clear statement. They also need to be mindful of not inflaming anger in parts of the multicultural community, as we saw with Jacinta Namba-Jimpa Price. So they have a careful line to walk.
Mark, what are the political stakes for the opposition on immigration?
I think the stakes are actually really quite high. We saw that, as Karen mentioned, with Jacinta Namba-Chipper-Price, but also Scott Morrison's position and particularly Peter Dutton's position, probably more Peter Dutton, in fact, in terms of the Chinese community. So the coalition's has some cleaning up to do and has suffered some damage, I think, with migrant communities. And they're talking about a values test. I mean, this is one of the things that keeps being discussed. Now, if Karen's right, and I suspect she is, that they're going to talk about numbers. But if they're also talking about a values test, that is a separate issue and it has actually nothing to do with numbers. It doesn't restrict numbers in aggregate terms. I think in the context of their previous behaviour, the way that will be read by migrant communities is that you're talking about ways of, it's a sort of a dog whistle about whether or not we fit in or whether
are you Australian enough?
Yeah, are you Australian enough? Are you welcome? It's a sort of a... because of their record, I think they're risking something by dealing with this.
Well, time has beaten us again. We've been talking about being online and also the demands of this parliamentary year. Many Australians who get their music from the platform Spotify would have got their summary for the year and your listening age. My listening age that I received yesterday was 88. So,
okay, I'm obviously talking a lot. I need to know your top song now.
I think it's a love of Ella Fitzgerald that's got me there. Yeah. A friend got a listening age of 100. A few others are in the 20s and 30s. But, yeah, I do feel 88. If my ears are 88, I think my hips are 88.
I'm sure I saw that the top streamed artist, Australian artist on Spotify was The Wiggles. So I think there'll be plenty of people with younger age tallies from Spotify as a result of their kids listening. So maybe you're helping balance out the average. Mm-hmm. Sally.
But 88. I'm going to wear it with pride. Thanks so much.
I'm going off to listen to some John Coltrane after this.
Thank you very much. Mark Kenny is professor at the ANU's Australian Studies Institute. Mark, thank you for that.
Thanks,
host
Sally.
Of the Democracy Sausage. Karen Middleton, political journalist, author and columnist with The Monthly. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mel Clark, our very own. Thank you.
Thanks, Sal.